From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Tobacco use is the number one preventable cause of death in the U.S. Nicotine is a powerful addiction that leads to many a New Year's resolution to quit. And while e-cigarettes are marketed as tools to help, public health advocates fear they may be getting a new generation hooked. Whatever the source, Georgia offers little state-funded support to help break the habit. A new report ranks it 47th nationwide in funding programs to help smokers quit and prevent kids from using tobacco. John Schachter is director of state communications at the Campaign for Tobacco-Free Kids, which published the report, along with the American Cancer Society, the American Lung Association, and the American Heart Association. He's joining us on the line from Washington, D.C. And John, welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here to talk about such an important issue.
Well, thanks for being with us. Also with us in the studio, Michael Erickson. He's dean of the College of Public Health at Georgia State University and former director of the Office on Smoking and Health at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Michael, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Virginia.
All right, I'm going to start with John because your organization authored this report and assessed what states are doing to reduce tobacco use in the U.S. And you've been doing this since 1998. So start with your key findings about Georgia. Why does it rank so low?
Well, this is our annual report on whether the states are using the billions of dollars they get from the tobacco settlement from 20 years ago and from their tobacco taxes, and whether they're using that money to protect kids from tobacco. And most states get a failing grade. Georgia is particularly low in the rankings because the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC, recommends that Georgia spend $106 million annually on tobacco prevention programs, and the state spends less than 1% of that, just $750,000 on it. So by ranking so low, it puts it 47th out of the 50 states in D.C.
You were the director of the Office on Smoking and Health at the CDC in 1998. This is when the master settlement agreement was reached between what were then the four largest U.S. tobacco companies and attorneys general of 46 states. So please just remind us of how that settlement came to be.
Yes, Virginia. 20 years ago, or more like 25 years ago, the process really started in an unlikely way. Michael Moore, who was the attorney general in the state of Mississippi, decided that the tobacco company should pay for the harm that they caused throughout the century. And he really launched an effort to engage all the attorney generals from the states in America to sue the tobacco companies to compensate them for the harm caused by smoking. Four states settled individually with the tobacco companies, but then there was the Master Settlement Agreement in 1998 where the tobacco companies agreed to pay over $250 billion, billion with a B, over 25 years to compensate states for the harm caused by smoking, and most importantly, to prevent that from occurring in the future. And that's the failure that's occurred, that the money has not been invested in a way to prevent the problem from occurring in the future.
So is it that there was no oversight about how that money was to be spent?
Very interestingly, there was nothing in the Master Settlement Agreement, which was over a 100-page legal document that stipulated how the money should be spent. It was felt that that was the authority of the state legislature to determine allocation of funds that came into the state. So despite the fact that both the plaintiffs, the states, and the defendants, the tobacco companies, agreed verbally that the purpose of the settlement payment was to prevent the epidemic from continuing in the future, virtually none of the money is spent for that purpose.
That's an awful lot of money for a verbal agreement.
And it may repeat itself if there's an opioid settlement, which is for your next show down the road.
Well, I'm sorry to hear that we are going to have to discuss that, but how much does Georgia actually receive? John or Michael, who wants to pick that up?
Well, I'm glad to talk about that. In the current fiscal year, Georgia will receive about $393 million from both the settlement and the tobacco taxes in the state, although the tobacco tax is one of the lowest in the country, so we'd love to see that increased for many reasons. But again, the state will receive $393 million and devoting less than 0.2% of that, the $750,000. So again, we'd love to see that increase. We're not talking about huge amounts necessary to be spent to combat tobacco use, but the fact that they're spending virtually nothing puts it in that rogues gallery of states that are just failing when it comes to tobacco prevention.
So out of that, $750,000 spent on tobacco prevention and cessation efforts, Michael, that's less than 1% of the CDC recommendation, never mind how much money is at stake. So where's the other money going?
Most of the money, 80% of the money, is going to low-income Medicaid in the state of Georgia. Now, obviously, low-income Medicaid is very important, but most states pay for Medicaid with state tax revenue or have expanded Medicaid to take advantage of the opportunity of getting more money from the federal government. Georgia has neither expanded Medicaid nor is using tax revenue to pay for Medicaid, and they're using the master settlement agreements for that purpose. It's really a missed opportunity for prevention, because I think now in 2019, we have a chance to do something with those funds that could never have been done before.
What do you think should be spent on tobacco prevention?
Well, the thing that we're really excited about is around what we call a lung cancer platform. Lung cancer, more people die of lung cancer than die of colon cancer, breast cancer, prostate cancer, and pancreatic cancer combined. And for the first time in history, there's a chance for primary prevention, like we've done in the past with tobacco control, but there's also screening, early detection that now works. And now, excitedly, there's treatment as well. So there's a complete package that could actually make a dent in the leading cause of cancer death that's never been done before.
John, you mentioned Georgia's tobacco tax being low. How does it compare to other states?
Well, it's only 37 cents per pack, so that's the third lowest of any state. Only Missouri and Virginia are lower. So we're, the average state tax is about $1.75. So we're really looking at a state that is not doing the thing that's both smart, the right thing to do, and the wise thing to do for financial reasons as well as to save lives.
How many smokers in Georgia? Do we have a sense of that?
Yes. There's over a million smokers in Georgia. We estimate it's about 1.25 million smokers. So there's a fair number of smokers here. What most people don't realize is that the profile of the typical smokers changed dramatically over the years.
How so?
Smoking used to be glamorous and associated with income and the good life. Over the last couple of decades, that's changed now, and it's now become much of a marginalized habit. Most smokers are low income, low levels of education, have high comorbidities, other issues going on, substance abuse and mental health challenges. All of them want to quit, but we're not seeing the people who used to smoke in the past currently smoking. Only 5% of folks with a college education smoke, whereas over a third of high school dropouts smoke.
John, did you want to pick up on that?
Yeah, I think I was going to add to what Michael said, that a lot of these differences are in large part also due to the tobacco industry's targeting of vulnerable populations through advertising and price discounts and other marketing strategies. So tobacco is not an equal opportunity killer, and that's not a surprise anymore.
So how much are tobacco companies still spending on marketing?
Well, the industry spends about $9.5 billion a year. That's more than $1 million every hour to market its products. So it's estimated that it's about $350 million in Georgia alone. So that means for every $1 the state spends now on tobacco prevention, the industry is spending about $450 to drown out and dwarf that message. So it's just a battle that's bound to be lost unless the state steps up.
And it's not just tobacco use. It is nicotine. Your report, John, also calls e-cigarette use a growing epidemic among youth in America. So let's talk about the Juul. This is a sleek little piece of technology. This is especially catching on with teenagers, reported to be less harmful to your lungs than smoking cigarettes. So what is the concern among public health officials about e-cigarettes like Juul?
Well, one thing to keep in mind is that each Juul pod contains as much nicotine as a pack of cigarettes. But many kids who use Juul don't even realize they're inhaling nicotine. So it is a real crisis that we have to address before it gets worse, because we've seen the CDC and the FDA have pointed out that youth use of e-cigarettes increased by 78% this year. And nobody, certainly not anybody under the age of 25, should be using nicotine products. The brain is still developing, so becoming addicted to nicotine is still a problem. Now, if we could get every smoker to switch to e-cigarettes completely, that's a different story, but that's not necessarily what we're seeing. And when we're talking about kids especially, we shouldn't be talking about nicotine addiction and products that are luring them in, that especially for kids who haven't been using nicotine products before.
Well, Juul, of course, makes the case that this is much better for you than smoking. But Michael, you found that tobacco giant Philip Morris just bought a big share in Juul, now owns a third of the company. What do you think is going to come out of that, and how will the FDA respond?
Well, that's the million-dollar question. FDA is obviously very upset and under a lot of pressure to deal with the issue of nicotine use and electronic cigarettes among young people. And at the same time, they want to move smokers from smoking combusted products, and that these electronic products hold promise as smoking cessation devices, although it's an unrealized promise at this point. We've done a very poor job, and this, when I say we, I mean the government, regulators, public health agencies, communicating to smokers how important it is to stop using combusted products, however they do it. And if e-cigarettes can play a role in that, that would be great. The reality is that in our own study at Georgia State, we found that 90% of people who did both smoke cigarettes and used e-cigarettes were still smoking a year later.
Hmm.
And that's really not a good outcome.
So it is not doing as promised. Could either of you give an example of an effective policy you think in another state that has actually succeeded in keeping kids from smoking and helping people who already smoke to quit? Michael, want to start?
Yeah, I'll start. I can't think off the top of my head of any state that I would hold up as a role model in today's world around keeping kids from using e-cigarettes. I think there's the issue that it's technologically attractive, it's cool, it's surreptitious. People don't know that they're doing it, and the kids will be kids in some ways. I think the advertising that Juul has done has exacerbated that. They've used social media exquisitely and have appealed to young people. I think there are things that can be done going forward. FDA needs to play an important role. The issues that John has mentioned around tax and other things need to be done more consistently across the country. But we really need to do a better job educating smokers, existing smokers, that the most important thing they can do is quit combustion immediately.
John, any thoughts on that? You want to cap off?
Yeah, if we look at some states that have had a long-standing, ongoing tobacco prevention and cessation program, states like Florida, just to the south, where they had massive media campaigns, paid media campaigns, as well as consumer education, and they've driven their youth smoking rate down to 3.6%, one of the lowest ever recorded by any state. So if they continue, if states continue to fund these programs or start funding them greater, having these paid media campaigns on top of education and aggressive quit lines, then we can probably educate kids and adults again even further on the e-cigarette epidemic as well. And so we've seen states that have been successful in it in the past. We just need to keep up the fight, because we know the industry is going to keep up the fight.
Michael, 20 seconds left. How could Georgia do better in the future, maybe under a Kemp budget, in fact?
Well, I think there's a path forward that can make Georgia a leader in the nation, and that is to really aggressively address lung cancer. As I mentioned, by looking at prevention, screening, and treatment, 90% of all lung cancer is caused by smoking, and it kills more people than all the other cancers combined. So lung cancer aggressively addressed in Georgia could make a world of difference.
Yeah, a long way to go from number 47. Michael Erickson, Dean of the College of Public Health at Georgia State University, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And John Schachter, he's Director of State Communications for the Campaign for Tobacco-Free Kids. Thank you.
My pleasure.
Stick around. There's more on Second Thought coming up after a short break. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Suicide is the second leading cause of death among Americans aged 15 to 29. That's according to the World Health Organization. In Georgia, suicide rates increased by 16% between 1996 and 2016. After a string of suicides were live streamed on Facebook in 2017, the social media giant announced it would use artificial intelligence to scan posts for indications of self-harm and notify local authorities to intervene. Natasha Singer covers technology for The New York Times. She reported on some successes and concerns about the process a year in and joins us on the line from California. Hello, Natasha. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Larry Harris Jr. is an Atlanta musician and an activist, and he's also a suicide survivor who posted his attempt online. Larry, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Natasha, I'm going to start with your reporting. Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg announced in 2017 they were hiring 3,000 more people to monitor for crimes and suicide and other self-harm. This was after some killings had been shown live. How does the process work?
Well, there's two ways that Facebook gets information to act on potential suicidal thoughts or attempts. And one is when somebody posts something on Facebook, you know, there's a little arrow you can click and you can report posts for certain things,
mm-hmm.
right? You can report hate speech and you can report if you're concerned about a friend's post and think they may be suicidal. So that goes directly to Facebook's human review team. And the second way is that Facebook has developed this computer algorithm that scans the posts of users in the United States, both their posts and their videos and their comments, and it scores every single one between 0 and 1. It looks at all the words and it makes a determination about whether the system thinks that you are at immediate risk of suicide. And if you get a really high score, like 0.95, that post is automatically elevated again to Facebook's human review team, and then they look at it and they decide, you know, should we send this person resources online, like a phone number for our hotline, or is it so risky, should we call the police?
Mm-hmm.
And they've been calling the police, not just around the United States, but in India and Malaysia and various other countries. And the police then go to the scene of where the person is, and if they're in the middle of trying to commit suicide, they try to stop it. In some cases, Facebook has made calls that are too late, and it's been too late to save people.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are other situations, you know, which may arise in which the police show up. And in one case that I found in Ohio, the woman whose house the police arrived to said, yeah, but I don't feel suicidal right now.
Mm.
And the police said, yeah, but, you know, you made the suicidal post, which Facebook sent us, and you have to go to the hospital and have a psychiatric exam. So you can either come voluntarily or we're going to take you into police custody and take you for a psych exam. And so clearly Facebook has to do something and we want them to, but we don't know if the system is effective,
yeah.
And we don't know if it's safe, and we don't know if some people who are in fact not suicidal are being forced to have psych exams and may be committed.
So this is obviously, it's some assets, some liabilities, and you reported on how it works in a couple of cases, including one in Rock Hill, South Carolina, where the police were informed unable to locate somebody, but Facebook, with its absolute precision analytics, was able to do it. So there is, they have a lot of information here. And Facebook reported that they'd be alerting first responders in 3,500 cases. So that's pretty significant and a pretty good headline for a company after a string of bad headlines. Most recently, these revelations that have been passing on a lot more user data than disclosed. So what are the privacy protocols for posts that send up red flags about possible suicide attempts?
So one of the issues is your posts are being scored. And what happens to that when your posts are scored as suicidal? And Facebook says that after 30 days, if your posts are not flagged for possible suicide risk, those scores disappear. And Facebook says they are not using that information, for example, to allow drug companies to market antidepressants to users. But the further question is, you know, once Facebook has called the police, sometimes they've shared people's posts. Sometimes they've shared people's videos. What happens if there's illegal substances or guns or something in that context,
mm-hmm.
right? And
mm-hmm.
so there's no warrant involved. So, you know, again, if somebody's in the middle of making a suicide attempt, there's no question that A, society would like Facebook to try to stop that, and B, they have a duty to warn, right? So we're not talking about the extreme cases. We're talking about what are these things in the middle that are middle ground that we don't know how Facebook is making decisions, so we don't know what the potential risks are, and Facebook told me that they're not tracking the outcomes. They don't know what happens after they make a phone call. Hmm. So they have called the police 3,500 times over the last year in the United States. But how many of those people, you know, had cops show up at their house that didn't need to show up and that caused a chain of reactions and left some people with police reports for the rest of their lives, right? And so the problem here is not Facebook's good intentions. It's the lack of transparency. They're behaving like a doctor, right? They're behaving like a public medical institution, screening people for suicide, calling the cops, which end up sending people for psychiatric exams. But, you know, they're not behaving with the transparency of a public health institution that would tell us how the process works and what the outcomes are.
Yeah, basically saying maybe we failed on all of these other privacy concerns, but you can trust us with this one.
And, you know, we don't know if we can or we can't. We would certainly love this to work because if their system works, then they could share it publicly, and all the other groups who are involved in suicide prevention might be able to learn something. Or if there's some kind of tensions or bumpy areas, other groups who've been working at this longer could share it with Facebook. And so the problem is Facebook is a private company, right, with private policies and practices, but they're taking on a public health role while acting like a private company with secrets.
Well, Larry, you have struggled with suicidal feelings and attempts, and you posted about attempting suicide online. Do you feel comfortable telling us about that experience?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So what happened?
Well, just a little background. I was in Boston up until 2007 in school, and I started a nonprofit there. Never had any symptoms that I knew about, but was diagnosed bipolar in 2007 as I was leaving Boston to move to Miami to start a record label. So I was dealing with the diagnosis and doing a lot of research about my diagnosis. Spent a lot of time in Miami making music. On this point, I can relate to Kanye West. As I was making music, didn't want to take my medication because I felt it would inhibit my process. So ended up not taking meds for a long time in Miami, was making some great music, felt great about it, had great feelings because I was manic. So that manic is a very seductive frame of mind. It feels good. You have a lot of energy, but it's not ultimately safe. So at one point in 2012, I attempted suicide in Miami. Fortunately, was not successful and was hospitalized. And I ended up writing about it for the Huffington Post and posting on Facebook about it and all that kind of stuff because I wanted to be an advocate for people that were in the same position that had feelings that were either dark or manic and didn't know what to do about it.
So there was no intervention for you, Facebook aided, but you did post about it publicly.
I did.
So why do you think so many people do turn to social media to announce their suicide attempts?
Well, I think people feel more emboldened behind a keyboard than they do talking to someone to their face. And sometimes people don't have people in their lives that they feel comfortable telling these things about their feelings and emotions. I know as a man and as a Black man, you know, men feel that sharing a lot of times in male friendships, we're devoid of, you know, real conversations and feelings. And Black men especially have a hyper masculine view of ourselves and each other. So don't talk about these things and don't seek treatment and often self-medicate. So, you know, I think in a lot of cases, people feel more comfortable sharing online because it's not necessarily going to have a repercussion, even though maybe it does now with Facebook's intervention strategies.
That's Larry Harris Jr. He's a suicide survivor and a musician and producer. And also with us is Natasha Singer, who's reported and followed Facebook's AI for suicide risks and interventions. I'd love you to pick up on that, Natasha. This is not something you necessarily reported on, but there was a lot of talk in the last couple of years, and in fact, some accusations that Facebook was implicated in the increase in self-harm, you know, providing a platform or normalizing, not just for men, as Larry was talking about, but especially for young women. Any real data behind that?
I don't think we have data that quantifies the trend, but certainly last year, a number of people around the world did live stream suicides and suicide attempts on Facebook Live. And one of the questions that the psychiatrist I interviewed asked was, you know, what role are social media platforms like Facebook and Instagram playing on increased suicide rates, depression, you know, young girls feeling bad about how they look and eating disorders? You know, how do these platforms unintentionally foster our feeling of being lonely, even though we can broadcast to many, many people? And when we talk only about Facebook's good intentions in trying to solve this problem, we leave out the important question you've just asked, which is, what is the role of these companies actually in making the problems worse? Mm-hmm. And should they change how the platforms work in some way to try to minimize the emotional toll on people?
So Facebook has this precision risk scoring technology, and it's offering some aid to a mental health system that is really strained here in the U.S. You talked a little bit about the privacy implications, but how about the idea of a social media company actually monitoring mental health?
Right. So you asked a really important question because you described it as like this precision algorithm, but we don't actually know, mm-hmm. right? Because it's a black box.
Right. I assume that it is because Facebook knows so much about all of us already.
Right. But actually, when I spoke to them and asked them, how did you develop this algorithm? Did you develop it based on the language of users you know to have either tried to commit suicide or did commit suicide? They said they had based the algorithm on the reports that users filed to Facebook about their friends that they were concerned about and that their teams acted on. So the algorithm is designed to predict which posts that users file to Facebook their folks will act on. Right? Mm-hmm. It's not actually developed on people who were suicidal that we know to have been suicidal. So, like, we actually don't know. Clearly, Facebook has huge computing power and the most sophisticated software engineers. So, you know, we would think that this would be very, very effective, but they haven't produced any effectiveness data because they're not following how effective it is. And what's really interesting is that other companies have tried to do similar things, like Microsoft a few years ago tried to see if looking at the language on Twitter, they could predict depression. And they actually got people to volunteer, right? Because on Facebook, you're being scanned for suicidality, whether you like it or not. But Microsoft did a real study where they got people to volunteer who were clinically depressed, and those people agreed to give Microsoft access to all their tweets over time. And so Microsoft came up with an algorithm that was actually developed on depressed people, and they published this report. So we know what the outcome was, which was they were 70% accurate at predicting depression. And I interviewed the Microsoft folks, and they were like, you know, this might be useful to help the CDC figure out on a population level, you know, where pockets of depression might be around the United States that we didn't know about, but it should not be used on individuals, right? We're not there yet. 70% is not very accurate when it comes to individuals. And the consequences of a company that is not a medical institution diagnosing people as being depressed or suicidal, you know, without their consent, and the implications of, like, where might that data go? How might that affect you? It's something we've never dealt with before. And so it's really important to ask these questions because obviously we would like the technology to be able to better identify people who need resources. Well, and we'd like it to be able to identify them earlier. But we just don't know if this works right now.
Well, Larry, how about for you? I mean, you were in that place. You were struggling with bipolar disorder in this manic phase. Mentioned Kanye West, who has made several Twitter rants about mental illness and and saying things like, you know, I cannot be on meds and make Watch the Throne level or dark fantasy level music. So that fear that treating your illness would also, what, dull your creativity?
Yeah.
Was that the fear?
That there is that fear. And I think it's unfounded. Artists really don't know. They feel great when they're manic and make great music, and maybe they attribute the making of the great music to the mania, but they really don't know. There's no data that says, yes, on meds, right, you're not a good musician, and off meds, you're a great musician. So, I mean, there was a wonderful article in The Atlantic about this, but basically, you know, if you're an artist and you think you are struggling with your mental health, I would encourage you to find the right dosage and the right level of treatment instead of trying to get off your meds and self-medicate or self-regulate. You know, talk to your doctor, because sometimes you're on too much of something or on the wrong medication.
Well, how did it feel for you putting this out there on social media? Were you looking for someone to intervene? Would you have liked it if, you know, a first responder had knocked at your door and said, like, I care, I'm listening, because Facebook found it?
Well, actually, what happened to me is that I used to talk to my mom every morning in Miami, and sometimes I would get up and be manic, and she would detect it on the phone. And so she called the police for me to have me hospitalized when I was in Miami from Georgia. So, you know, I can understand Facebook playing a role, and it is important that people's comments are taken seriously and they get flagged for suicidal tendencies. I just think that it's important, like Natasha was saying, that the data be shared and they be more transparent, because I trust my mom. My mom knows my mental health state, but I don't know if I trust Facebook to do the same thing that my mom was doing, you know?
Well, this is very much what comes up. But however, if there is somebody who is looking for help, what do you recommend?
Well, first of all, you can text 741-741 to the crisis emergency line, and you will get a you'll get a text back, and then they'll connect you with a therapist who will talk you down from whatever state of mind you're in. There's also a lot of resources available online. If you're feeling some sort of way, I would say do some research, go online, use your phone, and find ways to know more about what's going on so you can seek help.
Larry Harris Jr., he's a suicide survivor. Thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
And Natasha Singer, she's a New York Times technology reporter and reported on Facebook's role on suicide risks. Thank you so much for joining us, Natasha.
Thanks for having me.
Stay with us. There's more on Second Thought coming up right after the break. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Tickets for the Infinity Mirror Show at Atlanta's High Museum of Art sold out in just 2 days. The exhibit is a career retrospective of Japanese artist Yayoi Kusama. Each room is filled with twinkling lights, colorful shapes, and objects with polka dots, large and small. The exhibit's appeal is no surprise to Keenan Johnson, one of the High's newest board members. Johnson is National Director of Urban Promotions at Interscope Records. He grew up in Harlem, attending LaGuardia High School of Music and Arts. The movie Fame was based upon student life at that school. Inside a High Museum gallery, Johnson explained why he jumped at the chance to represent minority artists and audiences as soon as he got the call.
It was that moment. We're doing this. You know, for me, I know where I come from. I come from humble beginnings. You know, every step of my journey in life, I feel like we're breaking down new walls. And for me, this is definitely a breaking down of new walls and an opportunity for me to introduce my community to this beautiful gem called the High Museum. Art literally changed my life. It made me realize that there was much more to the world than what was going on just in Harlem. And Harlem was an amazing place to grow up because it was so rich in our own culture, but being able to go to the High School of Music and Arts and just meet different people from different backgrounds, it just changed my worldview early in life. You know, if you grab a kid's mind from the beginning and plant those seeds, I'm the example that seed will grow. The Kusama exhibit is basically the hottest ticket in town. Picture yourself in like a dark club, but it's just you. And all of a sudden, there's just a kaleidoscope of lights that are just flashing in your eyes, and it's just changing, and it's going in different direction, and it's switching, and it's going back and forth. And it's like you're in this magical wonderland that only you are experiencing at that time. It's kind of like you go down in this little rabbit hole of just colorfulness. I definitely think this exhibit takes Atlanta onto the international stage and cements it as an international city. Like, for a long time, I felt like Atlanta was a big town, and it was fighting for its opportunity to grow into becoming an actual world-class city. And I finally feel like, you know, the exhibit and the art community and the business culture that's coming here is finally representing what Atlanta always wanted to be. I think the next 50 years of the High Museum definitely represents more inclusiveness, more representation, not just from artists, but also from the community as a whole. I think this was a great first step, bringing a person like myself on board. And frankly, I would like to see more people like myself on the board moving forward. Ultimately, you know, we live in a world where influence matters and representation matters. And I think people like myself can bring a great amount of influence with the right people that can help propel this museum forward and get, you know, like I said, people from different backgrounds more interested in being super familiar with this whole community of art and the High Museum.
That was Keenan Johnson, National Director of Urban Promotions at Interscope Records and a new member of the High Museum of Art's Board of Directors. The interview was produced by GPB's Ricky Bevington and Sophia Salaby. The CDC reports that 19 states around the country, including Georgia, are experiencing higher than average flu activity. Last year's flu was the worst in four decades. Influenza season peaks between December and February. So how can we prevent the flu in our own backyard? Well, Andy Miller is editor of Georgia Health News and joins me in the studio. Hello, Andy.
Good to be here.
Well, great to have you with us. And I'm curious about, has Georgia typically been a state that's ranked high in flu activity?
I think it just varies on the year. But this year, we are definitely high. Early on, we had the highest flu activity of any state during this flu season. And the numbers don't look good right now. They've got public health officials worried.
So what are we looking at for numbers, percentages?
Well, there's a couple ways to look at this. One is we've had in the 8-county metro area 440 flu hospitalizations so far this flu season. That compares with last year's 193. So it's double what it was last year, and we know how severe last year was.
Any clues onto reasons why it has soared here in Georgia? And much of the South apparently has also been hit hard by the flu.
The virus that's predominant here in the Southeast, including Georgia, is the H3N2 virus versus nationally, the predominant virus now is H1N1. H3N2 was the predominant strain last flu season, so it probably is a more severe danger to people than what's going on nationally.
So what kind of – the CDC, they get flu updates. They send them out every week on how each state is doing. So as a journalist, how are you interpreting that data, and what are you looking for?
Well, basically, I look for numbers. We've had four flu deaths this year so far versus last year we just had one reported. So looking at the numbers and also what hospitals are doing, I mean, there's at least one hospital in the state that's restricting visitors during this flu season. So you listen to public health officials, they're concerned. You look at, you know, the statistics that are out there, and you get the reports from hospitals about what they're seeing. I mean, last flu season, Grady Memorial here in Atlanta opened a mobile ER unit right outside its regular ER to handle the overflow from its ER. So, and we haven't really seen the cold weather yet. We know that's going to bring out, that's going to kind of lead to probably more flu incidents.
More than 80,000 Americans died of flu and flu complications in 2017. That's according to a CDC report, and a huge jump from previous years. So how do local public health officials and hospitals judge whether a flu season is better or worse than previous years? Is it strictly in numbers? What's being measured?
Well, they also look at what I haven't mentioned yet is outpatient visits to doctors. So far this year nationally, 4% of outpatient doctor visits have been flu-related. In Georgia so far, it's been over 7% of those visits are flu-related. So they look at that type of marker, and they just look at volumes. I mean, wintertime is usually a crowded time for hospitals, and they'll see the numbers go up based on, you know, their volumes and whether they have bed capacity to handle all the patients that are coming in.
So that's what we're watching for. What are you watching for or cautious about for the rest of the flu season? Looking at these numbers of deaths, looking at what's happening, are there any other problematic indicators for the next couple of months?
Well, one problem indicator, Virginia, I looked at, and it was early on, it was a survey of seniors in the Savannah area. And just 70% of those seniors indicated that they were going to get a flu shot. Which was higher than the national average, but still, I mean, that leaves 30% of seniors in that area and probably across the state that were not planning to get a shot. I mean, it's not too late to get vaccinated, certainly.
Well, seniors are among the populations at most high risk for flu. What are some of the others?
Well, kids five and under is a, you know, especially kids like two and under are definitely an area to watch for. We had a very high number of pediatric deaths nationally last year. Plus, people who have immune system problems, you know, ongoing chronic conditions. I mean, those people are also very vulnerable.
How about pregnant women? Is it safe for them to get flu shots?
It is. Both during and after pregnancy, it is safe for women to get a flu shot.
Do we know now at this stage in the game what percentage of the population outside of those in Savannah, the seniors you mentioned, have actually received flu shots?
We don't know yet. We do know statistically, historically, that Georgia really does have a pretty good vaccination rate, especially of kids. So that's the good news. And again, there are some people who for one reason or another, have myths about the flu, like, you know, they think they can get sick from it. They actually think that they can get flu from a flu shot. And we need to break through those myths and just reemphasize the fact that the vaccine is safe. And also, people need to know if they have the flu, don't go to work. Don't go to school. Stay home. And people should, in general, for those people that don't have symptoms to prevent problems, you know, they should do proper hygiene, like good washing of hands. And if you sneeze, you know, cover up your sneeze or your cough. And, you know, people just need to be smart.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the virus that you mentioned, the H3N2. Tell us a little bit more about the different strains and how clinicians actually tell them apart.
Well, it's through testing and, you know, through observation. The CDC does a really good job in terms of tracking things like that. There are a lot of scientists who would like to be more predictive in terms of being able to head things off before outbreaks occur rather than kind of doing it retroactively like we do now. So there's a whole scientific push to do better predictive analysis of where these outbreaks are going to occur.
And when you say testing, what is it that actually diagnoses the flu?
Well, lab testing. I mean, they
said, it has to be a blood test, that kind of thing.
There is lab testing of people with these symptoms to determine, you know, what actually they have, but I think that you know, when I talked to a public health official recently, I said, "What's the biggest thing that concerns you?" And of all the things that are out there, and he mentioned flu, and this was prior to last year. So it's something that's unpredictable and it's dangerous, certainly for vulnerable populations.
So how about spreading it? Maybe somebody feels a little run down, don't quite know that they have the flu, certainly yet go to work. Can people spread the flu without knowing that they have it?
They can. And that's where symptom awareness is very important. I think if people are feeling run down, sick, and certainly if they have a fever, they should stay home.
So how many people actually get the flu in a given flu season?
Well, it's, you know, certainly thousands. I mean, if we had 80,000 deaths last year, which was, as you said, the highest number in 40 years. We know that, you know, there's, you know, it's many more times that number actually get it.
I'm speaking with Andy Miller. He's editor of the Georgia Health News. And we're talking about the flu in Georgia this year. It's a serious season and a serious and Georgia's at higher risk or having more cases of the flu than almost any other state. During a bad flu season, you mentioned that Grady Hospital put a little mobile unit outside. What are some of the other ways that people are adapting, and hospitals and doctors and caregivers adapting so that other people don't get the flu?
Well, I think, first of all, you know, the public health awareness of what can happen, I think last year kind of triggered more people thinking about this in terms of the regular population. And I think hospitals staff up during this time of year. It's a busy time for hospitals anyway. And especially with the cold weather about to come, you know, it's something that they try to prepare for in terms of staffing and resources. And you know, they obviously want to have a lot of Tamiflu available for folks who do get the influenza problem.
So high flu outbreaks do lead to, of course, you know, the terrible human cost and high hospitalizations and doctor's visits. Is there a calculation of the financial cost for a state when people do not get flu shots, or how much the flu actually costs?
Well, hospitalizations can run, you know, hundreds and thousands of dollars per day. So when you get that bad, and we have 440 hospitalizations in Metro Atlanta just in the 8-county area. So we know that there's a tremendous cost here. And the irony there is the flu shot for people with insurance is free.
Mm.
And you know, it's painless, relatively. You know, you can just go in and get it quickly at any drugstore or outpatient clinic.
You can get a gift certificate in many retailers.
Exactly. So it's very, very fast to do it. You know, you don't need to spend your whole afternoon waiting in line. You can get it quickly. It's obviously free for most Americans. It makes just tremendous health sense.
Andy, you've worked in health journalism for more than 25 years. Has coverage of the flu changed over the years? I mean, do you think people know more about the flu now than they did maybe 10 or even 15 years ago?
I think it's a good question. And how I will answer that is, I think last year was a real wake-up call, not just for the general public, but for journalists as well, to pay attention to this issue, because, you know, 80,000 deaths estimated across the country. I mean, that's a huge, huge number.
And we're talking about the flu. There are common sense things you mentioned, of course, washing your hands, covering your nose, staying home if you're sick. Why has the severity of the flu increased over the past few years, given that we have this public health awareness of basic wellness of not spreading the flu?
Well, I think it's such an unpredictable thing, and the strains are different each year. There's so many different factors that lead to severe flu seasons, and also vaccine effectiveness is also a factor. If the flu vaccine, sometimes the flu vaccine is very effective against the strains that are out there. Sometimes it's less effective.
Mm-hmm.
But public health people caution, you know, no matter how effective it is, you need to get a flu shot because it will help protect you and it'll help protect your friends and family.
Andy Miller, he's editor of Georgia Health News. Thanks so much.
Good to be here, Virginia.
I'm assuming you got your flu shot.
I did, early on.
Absolutely. And that is our show for today. On Second Thought is produced by Elena Rivera, Leighton Rowell, and LaRaven Taylor. Tyler Morris is our engineer. Alex Kaslow is helping out today. Don Smith is our dean of grammar. And Amy Kiley, our tireless senior producer. Well, you can join the conversation. We are on Facebook. We're on Twitter at OST Talk. You can email us at onsecondthought@gpb.org. I'm Virginia Prescott. Thanks so much for spending some time with us today. This is On Second Thought.